Many have told me that it's good to see me back, and let me just say that it's very good to be back. One of two major concerns I had the last couple of weeks in China was that we would make our connecting flight to Hong Kong to return, because we had made those flight reservations separately from the others, and I wasn't sure what would happen if we didn't get there in time. My other concern was whether it was my Sunday night to preach when I got back, so I figured out that it was. And since that was the case, I thought, since some impressions that I had while I was there working were so fresh in my mind and indelibly printed there, that I might just share some of those things with you. The work there is not unique in any way to foreign work. There's some things that are different about it than other places. There are other efforts being made other places. It's no more important than any other kind of work, but I think that you might have an interest, as many have expressed, in hearing some things about the work there. In terms of China itself, when one goes to a place such as that, I think just as an American, there are probably reasons on the one hand to sort of be filled with a certain degree of pride or ego about things, on the other hand, reasons to be humble. I think on the one hand, when a person goes to a country whose economy is not as developed as ours, our reaction is easily to think that things are better in the States. We have it so much better. We see maybe a lot of poverty in places like this, and we think of how much we have. And then there's this matter of going to what they call English Corner in some of these Chinese cities, where the Chinese will gather usually on a weekend, probably on a Sunday morning or afternoon, and many will come, a lot of them students, in order to improve their English. They really want to speak and mostly hear people speak English, because they're trying to develop their skills. And I know that you've not had the opportunity to do that, but you get instant celebrity status when you go to one of those places, because just immediately you are surrounded by Chinese people who want to hear you speak and answer, want you to answer all kinds of questions. So you get a little feeling for what it's like to be a celebrity. So there is that side to it. But on the other hand, I think it's a very humbling experience in many ways to realize that there are many places like this where there are millions and millions of people, and they have maybe not shared in the prosperity that we have, and yet they have ongoing needs, physical needs, things that that are important to them. They live their life as we live ours here, and things are just as important to them in terms of their life as they are to us, and no less so. I think another factor is it's intimidating to be in a foreign culture and find yourself suddenly sort of in the minority, and especially again in China, an American, especially one that's 6'3", stands out rather radically. And I think Lee told me, the preacher from Lilburn that went with me, he said several days into the trip, he said he just couldn't get over the stares. You get a feeling for what it might be to be like in a freak show at a circus or something like that, because you're just greeted with stares. You get on an elevator and maybe you hear laughs and some communication exchange that you can't understand. You know that you're the object of that, not necessarily in an unkind way, but I think that's particularly intimidating. But I think the thing that draws me to China, it would be a wonderful place to visit if I had time and money to go and see some of the sites that we have yet to see, because that's not really the reason that we're there. That's not really the appeal. The appeal is merely that there's such a great opportunity. And I think that's what I was impressed with the first time, and just reconfirmed that this time, to go and find so many that know so little about the Bible. Of course, working in China is different in many ways, I suppose, and I told Lee, and I would tell others. I have not been to other places such as the Philippines and some areas like that, but I can imagine that working in China as it now stands is much easier in many ways. Because when we go, we book a hotel and we stay in a hotel room, and that really becomes our classroom, and people come to visit us there, and we have some of the American amenities to which we're so accustomed. A hot shower that we can take in the morning, a nice comfortable room to be in, very accommodative, good service as far as the staff of the hotel are concerned. We can go out and eat at McDonald's or KFC. Those sorts of things, as opposed to, I would imagine, going to some countries where one might stay with the people there and live strictly on their culture as they know it. And so in many ways, it's easier to go to a place like this. But it is a different culture. And as I say, the thing that drives, I think, the interest there is just the overwhelming opportunity. I made a hurried check before I left home of the little journal that I had kept, and I listed all the names of people with whom we had studied, and then put the bullet there for the numbers to sort of number those, and I came out with 49. I don't know how accurate that is. 49 different people. A few of those the members with whom we studied, but many of those just people who have almost no knowledge of the Bible. And so it is a wonderful opportunity, and I want to maybe try and explain a few things as far as what we do and what we try to accomplish there. Let me add this footnote at the outset. There's probably some question in your mind as to this matter of security and speaking as we do when we're there. Brad Butcher kindly loaned us his computer, laptop computer to use. We were able to send email. But as I understand it, that is all under the surveillance of the Chinese government there. What we're doing there is probably, for all intents and purposes, illegal. We're carrying copies of the Bible in. We are talking to people about the Bible. And if that were a common knowledge, I suppose that we would be asked to leave the country. On the other hand, we're not lying or trying to deceive anyone about what we do. We do keep a low profile. If we were questioned about our activity, I would hope and pray that I would be honest in the answers that I gave. Fortunately, that did not occur. But there is concern not only for our own welfare, but I think more importantly for the Christians who are there, who on occasion have been persecuted. We were even warned while we were there about taking certain precautions because of what the police do in terms of their concern for looking at anybody that's involved in any sort of activity that they would deem illegal. So there is that concern. We try to be honest in our dealings with others, but at the same time, we try and carry out things in such a way that we can continue having opportunities to teach. And that might explain some of what we try to do while we're there. Let me just show you a quick map here, which is a great map of China. Unfortunately, it doesn't have any of the places we've been to, so that might cause you to wonder about where these towns are. But let me assure you that even though they're not named on this map, each of those places has a population of over 2 or 3 million. The place here in the south, the little blue dot there across from Hong Kong, Victoria, is the town of Shenzhen. It has, I don't know what the population is now, I think something like 4 million. The Chinese government has opened up certain economic zones, and I don't know how many there are, maybe 4 or 5 throughout the country, 2 of them in the places that we visited. But I have some pictures that I've taken. I don't know how those are all going to turn out. They're not anything extraordinary. But we had an afternoon one day to go down into the middle of Shenzhen to the old part of the fishing village that used to be there. In 1980, it was a little small fishing village of about 20,000 people. And now here, about 18 years later, it is a booming city of about 4 million people. And maybe when I get these photos, you can see the comparison between the kind of town that it used to be and what it now is. All of that as a result of the government's policy of opening up these economic zones, of which Shenzhen is one. And as a result, there has been a large deal of investment on the part of the Chinese government to open it up for economic development, and there has been a lot of Western investment, a lot of foreigners that have gone in, and as a result, a lot of business that is transacted there. So it's right across from Hong Kong. I think initially, it was China's attempt to show that it could sort of rival Hong Kong in terms of its development, and it has done so to a large extent. It's still not on the same scale as Hong Kong. Of course, now Hong Kong has been absorbed back into the nation of China. But one of the remarkable things is there is a large population of young people. Someone told us there, and I have no reason to doubt it based on the people we saw walking down the street, the average age of the people in that city of 4 million is 27 years old. Because these are the younger people who are skilled to take the jobs that are needed to be taken in that city. So it's a very young population, a very educated population. The people that we're often studying with are people who've been to university, who have degrees, who know English to a great degree and can speak it, and certainly read it. And so there's great opportunity there that has opened up. In 1996, I went to Hangzhou, which is this second area just below Shanghai. I did not return there this time because there are others who have just come in the last week and are probably going to spend some time there. So instead, Lee and I made a flight of about 3 hours up to Dalian, which is this small dot here on the east coast of China, about the same latitude north as Beijing is, quite a ways north. And I learned when I got there, not only was it a big city, not only does it have its own economic development zone a few miles away, not only is it booming in terms of the building that they're doing that's changing the face of that city, but we learned from one of the Christians there, who is an older man, who has been there for about 75 years, that it's got a very interesting history. It first was controlled by the Japanese from about the turn of the century until 1945, the end of World War II. After that, because Russia had gone in and because of the negotiations that took place after World War II, Dalian was handed over to the Russians, and they controlled it from 45 to 53, at which time, apparently, at the end of the Korean conflict, the truce that came as a result of that conflict, Dalian was then transferred from the Russians back to the Chinese, to whom it originally belonged. And so those people there, especially the older ones, have known occupation by the Japanese than the Russians, and then, of course, controlled by their own government, the Chinese. And those first two powers were not kind to them in any way or imagination. They were very oppressive in many ways. So it's an interesting city, a very strategic one in terms of its location. That it accounts for why it has been passed back and forth from one nation to the other. But again, because of efforts of others that have gone there, conversions have resulted, and there are Christians in that city, and again, I was overwhelmed by the opportunity that existed there, but I'll say a little more about that later. So we spent a couple of weeks in both Shenzhen and then flew up to Dalian, from which we left last week before we came home. But as I say, when involved in the activity there, I suppose thinking about the things we were doing, it seemed to me that there were some spiritual principles that I could see that were evidenced there that in many ways are the same that we see evidenced here and in any other place that the gospel has ever gone. I guess the difference in China is that even though, quote, missionary work has been done there in the past and the gospel in some form has gone in, that has not existed in any great measure for the last 40 or 50 years based on the control of the communist government. Since World War II, that opportunity from the outside has largely been shut off. And so you see the gospel going into a place, I suppose, like Eastern Europe, where it has not been before, at least for that generation. And when opportunity like that exists, it's amazing for me to see some of the things that result. For instance, I think that it's astounding at the lack of knowledge, the ignorance there is about the Bible in a place like this. Over in Romans chapter 10, verses, I guess, 12 to 14, actually, the Apostle Paul spoke there, no, actually it is verse 13. He concludes a preceding section by quoting from the prophet Joel concerning this day of the Lord when the gospel was going to be preached. And Joel had said, and Paul quotes it here in verse 13, "For whoever calls on the name of the Lord should be saved." And then in verse 14, he raises this question, "How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher?" Now, Paul's point is, if you're going to have this calling on the name of the Lord, as you did on the day of Pentecost, Peter quotes the same passage there, there's going to have to be some activity preceding that calling on the name of the Lord, such as someone going to preach the word, someone hearing that word, and having heard that word, believing that word. And I think the same principle applies to a field such as China, to go to a place where for all intents and purposes, the gospel has not been preached for a number of years. And as a result, there is a great deal of ignorance among the people. As I say, we did all of our teaching, for the most part, I can think of only one or two exceptions, in our hotel room. And time and again, the doorbell would ring, we'd go to the door, and here would be someone else coming in, maybe a friend of a friend who had studied with us previously. And we sort of got into a routine so that when someone new came, I had prepared a a sort of a chart series, Old Testament survey, part of which I'd done the preceding time. And so we just agreed that I would go through that with them. And so we would take out a complete Bible that we had brought in both the English and the Chinese. And I would start through from the very beginning and talk about God having created the earth and then just draw a timeline there and some charts that I'd made and talk about certain Bible characters and try and give them some idea of what the Bible is all about. And as I just briefly would mention different individuals, Adam and Eve, Abraham, David, Christ himself, to name a few, it's just amazing to mention those names and just to see this quizzical look on the faces of people and just, you know, shake their head and say, no, I don't know who that is. Just no knowledge of it whatsoever. Now, in a few cases, they would say, well, we have studied some Bible stories, not the Bible itself. We have heard of this person. Maybe they'd heard of Solomon, who is purported to be a very wise man and had many wise sayings. But other than that, just a real ignorance as far as what the Bible teaches. And of course, that's fulfilling to be able to sit down with someone like that and just point out some of the very basics of the Bible, things that would be so familiar to us and yet were unknown to them. And so there certainly is that ignorance among them. As a result, of course, they have the common condition that Paul describes in Romans 3, verse 23, that all have sinned and fallen short of the gospel, fallen short of the glory of God. And that being the case, even though we are two cultures who are radically different in a number of ways, eating habits are very different, just everything geared to different ways of life as far as the way that they live, the way we would live, the language sounding so totally different, being unable to understand any part of it. Yet there is something that we have in common with them. There is a common denominator that immediately brings us together, and that is this matter that we stand before God in need of salvation because we have sinned. It was interesting to me as we would read some passages in the Scripture and maybe point out this verse, Romans 3:23, and I would ask them, I would mention the word sin and ask them if they knew anything about that. In fact, that was on one of my initial charts when I would talk about the Garden of Eden. And again, often I would just get sort of a blank stare and I would ask them to look in the Chinese and the version that they were reading and tell me what that word said. And two or three times someone would look up and say, criminal, crime, to commit a crime. And that's probably the closest understanding they had ever had of this idea of sinning, doing something wrong, and really the idea being having sinned against God. Again, a concept that for all intents and purposes was unknown to them, maybe something that they had not thought about to any great degree. And so again, that was one of the efforts that we made to try and show them that we have sinned against God, and that puts us in a perilous condition. I think more than once we just talked among ourselves of how we could really cause them to focus on the fact that they stood in need of something as a result of their condition, not just that they didn't know about these events that we were describing, but that because of their sin, they were separated from God, and what that really meant to be separated from Him. And so that was one of the efforts that we made. And of course, as a result of that, we tried to share with them that the solution God had given to us was, of course, the gospel itself. Paul saying in Romans 1 and verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, not for the Jew first and also for the Greek. Now, inherent in what Paul says in Romans 1 and 16 is this need for someone, as we said earlier, to believe. But how can someone believe unless they hear the message about Christ? And so, again, something that just sort of evolved was that after having taken someone through an Old Testament survey, if they could stay longer, we would go ahead and do this. If not, if they came back for a second visit, we would study with them some selected passages from the Gospel of Luke and basically just go through Luke from one end to the other and point out to start with that in Luke chapter 1, Luke is telling us about the certainty of these things, that he's not just making up some story, some myth. And then to point out about Jesus, that Jesus did some wonderful miracles that, again, Luke said were told to him by eyewitnesses. And then to point out some selected passages as far as what Jesus taught, to talk about Jesus' attitude toward riches and not placing too much trust in them, to take a portion in Luke chapter 6 of what's similar to the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes there, and contrast what Jesus said in terms of who is blessed as opposed to whom we might think as being successful. And then to go to various parables, such as the parable of the sower in Luke chapter 8, or the parable of the prodigal son, to talk about repentance with them and the need that we have to turn toward God. To talk about discipleship, Luke chapter 9, where Jesus says to his apostles that if we're going to be his disciples, we're going to have to deny ourselves, take up our cross daily, and follow after him. And then we would close by pointing out at the end of Luke that Jesus did indeed die as he predicted that he would, that he suffered based upon the need to be this sacrifice for sin, and then he was raised from the dead just as he had said that he would be. The evidence being from Luke 24, the empty tomb that the women found when they went there on the first day of the week, and then the resurrected Savior appearing to the apostles as they were gathered together and appearing in bodily form, giving proof of his resurrection to them. And that's really the basis for believing in Jesus, is hearing this firsthand testimony about him. And so what better way than to share this message with them, to encourage them to take one of these New Testaments that we had brought and to go home and to read that and consider it for themselves. And indeed, a couple of times, initially we had some students who were very interested, almost eager to do whatever it was they needed to do, and we left feeling like, well, maybe they need some more time to think this through before they commit themselves. Well, I think another thing that was impressive to me is this whole principle may be found in other passages than 1 Peter chapter 2, but the idea that growth is really essential for us as Christians. It is necessary. If we don't grow, then really our faith begins to perhaps revert to disbelief. We become weaker, we become disobedient, I suppose. And of course, that was the case. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, "As newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word that you may grow thereby, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious." Peter says that all Christians at any stage of their growth are to be as newborn babes, eager to learn and to grow, and that growth coming primarily from the word that God has given to us. And it was encouraging to me this time to go back to Shenzhen where I had been before and to see some of the Christians that I had met with 18 months before and really to see how they were doing. In some cases, there were those who had become inactive. They weren't meeting very often with the church. And I might just point out that even the opportunity to meet together for the Lord's Supper is very limited. The group there at this point is able to meet that command by gathering on a Sunday night in a local restaurant. They can get together in a back room and they can shut the door there and they can have their worship service, their breaking of bread, and then afterwards they eat a meal. And I think there's no problem with what they're doing. They understand the distinction, but this is about the only way it's possible for them to gather without any real suspicion. But they're able to meet, they're able to be together. But knowing that they're still doing that after 18 months, that they're still making that effort, they're still trying to meet together. There were a handful of Christians there that were still involved, had grown a great deal. There were some who had not been as faithful. But it was impressive to me. One of the young men last time that we spent a great deal of time with was a man named Forrest. And again, I'll just explain, most of the Chinese have English names. Either a name they have chosen for themselves, it's nothing official, no document, or maybe someone has given them that name, but it certainly makes it easier for us coming in to call them by name. It would be impossible almost otherwise. But Forrest was a young man who last time was unemployed. He spent a lot of time with us. Because of that, he showed us around. He was very helpful to us. But I must admit, I had my concern about him, just how involved and interested he was. And he had said at that point in time, 18 months ago, that he was looking for a job. He wanted to be a manager in a factory. He had done that before. And I had my doubts. Was he really looking? Well, when we came back this time, Forrest was there. He was now working as a manager in a factory about an hour away from Shenzhen. He would drive there on the Monday morning in a bus and then come back on the Friday, usually. But he was eager to study from the time that we arrived. He came, I think, on the Saturday when we got in. He came on the Sunday. He proceeded to show up several times during the week when he'd have business that brought him to Shenzhen, and then he would finish his business in the afternoon, come to our hotel room. And the thing he wanted to do was to study the various books of the New Testament, particularly the epistles of Paul. He wanted to know what the overview of those epistles was. He wanted us to break them down chapter by chapter. And so we went through one epistle after another. I think we got through five or six, including the book of Romans, Ephesians, Colossians, Philippians. We typed up outlines on the computer that we have and were able to copy those off and give to him. And he was very grateful for those. And I was just impressed at the progress that this young man has made, of his deep interest in spiritual things. And maybe feeling like before that maybe he didn't have that great an interest, and seeing that demonstrated time and again. And there were others like him, the other Christians who were still faithful, who were wanting to learn, who would many times come during the week at great distance and cost to themselves, who would come to our hotel room just so they could spend 1 or 2 hours studying. And so I think demonstrated to me time and again was this idea that here were Christians who were interested in growing. And when you think about their growth, it's really totally dependent on what they do. There's no preacher there each week to preach a sermon to them as such. In fact, whatever sermons are preached have to come from the members themselves. There's no one there to prod them to study a lesson. There's no lesson that's being handed out. Their growth is entirely dependent upon them taking the New Testament or the Old Testament and making a self-study of those things. And what a challenge that is. Put yourself in that situation and ask yourself how you would fare if your spiritual growth depended solely upon the efforts that you were making or I was making in reference to those things. A great challenge, but one that many were accepting there. And so growth certainly is essential as far as the welfare of a group. But I think another thing that I found particularly humbling was that really anything we accomplished here and last time was directly a result of a foundation that others have laid. Paul talks in 1 Corinthians 3, 5 to 11, about this matter. Apparently the church at Corinth was divided because of those who had come and taught them. And the point that Paul makes in chapter 3 is that there's really no cause for glory or admiration about who it is that teaches a person. He says in verse 5, who then is Paul? Who then is Paul, and who is Apollos but ministers through whom you believe as the Lord gave to each one? I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then neither he who plants is anything, nor he who waters, but God who gives the increase. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, and each one will receive his own reward according to his own labor, for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field, you are God's building. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Really, the nature of the work in China has been that different ones go in for a short period of time. They teach as many as they can. They leave. And someone else comes in behind them, maybe 6 months later, maybe 3 months later, maybe a year later, tries to contact those people and teach some more. And it really just becomes a process, as I've suggested here, of finding those who have been taught, maybe finding some new ones who have not been taught, trying to teach them and trying to help them along the path. And as Paul says here, there's no cause for human glory in this. There's no beating of the breast in terms of arrogance as far as what we've accomplished. And I mentioned in the report that we had gone fishing, that we had caught a couple of fish, hoping that everyone would understand the analogy there to what Jesus says in Luke chapter 5. There were a couple of baptisms. Two young girls came as a result of invitations and study from a convert 18 months before by Mary Broadwell's brother Wilson when he was there. Her name is Lily. She was converted. And again, there's always this concern, will she be faithful in this sort of a context where she's more or less left on her own? Well, not only has she been faithful, she was a great help to us. just making contacts for us, booking a hotel for us when we got there. But it's obvious that she had been teaching her friends, these two young women that were baptized, were very meek, very humble girls who showed up, and when they studied, they said immediately they had been studying since others had been there, Kirk Moore, another individual who had been there to study, and they just said at the outset, we want to do whatever is necessary to become a Christian. So we had a couple of sessions with them to study, and they said they wanted to be baptized. And so last Monday, we met there in our hotel room, and we filled the bathtub, which is the most expedient way to do that, and we were able to baptize both of them into Christ. But as I say, no plaudits to ourselves. We were only following up work that had been done by others. And not only in that case, I was impressed by other individuals, other Christians, who made our job so easy. We did go to the English Corner in Dalian. We went to an English club in Shenzhen in an effort to try and talk to people and maybe interest them. And we had a few contacts from them, but by and large, our contacts, even the new ones, came as a result of the Christians there bringing people to us. One young man by the name of Edward in Shenzhen, not particularly impressive in terms of his knowledge. He had a lot of questions. In fact, he was raising the same question two or three times. We got kind of frustrated at times because we were answering the same thing over and over again at different sessions. But I'll tell you what Edward did do. He got on the phone, and he would phone this person or that person, and he had more contacts set up than I knew what to do with. He had people coming that he knew. We went and saw one of his friends in one of the places where they live and had a meal with her in-laws, and I was just impressed by his zeal for the gospel. A lot of things he didn't know and understand, but what he did know was that he needed to reach out and talk to others. And again, we were concerned often about security. What's this going to do to them? What does this mean for them? And Edward didn't seem fazed by that. And then when we got to Dalian, there was a young man we met two or three days after we'd been there, one of the Christians, Francisco. And I could tell just from the start that Francisco was very earnest, very, very serious about what we were doing. He didn't really joke and laugh very much. But what he did do was he brought others from English Corner. One young girl that he brought, whose name was Mary, he had met at English Corner, I think that week or the week before. He brought her, she brought a friend, she brought another friend. So contacts that came from contacts, but all as a result of this young man. I couldn't help but think of Andrew, John chapter 1, who listened to Jesus and then went and found his brother Peter and said, we have found the Messiah, and invited others to come. So the foundation that we laid was a result of work that others had done. Very quickly, a couple of other points, and then I'll close. The parable of the sower that we shared with different ones is certainly demonstrated. And even as we go and study with these different individuals, I think even more so this second time, I began to realize that it's really a weeding out process that we're doing. We do have many people come to visit us, but it becomes obvious that some have come because they want to speak English with someone, just like English Corner, or they want to come to a nice hotel for them and talk to some American, or to claim that they have an American friend. There were a couple of people in Dalian, and we were told by the preliminary report that this person or that person seems to have more of an interest in that aspect than the gospel. And sure enough, we studied with them some, but their second or third visits were just mainly to find out more about the States and perhaps to see if there's anything that we could do in helping them to maybe one day come over here and study with them. And that just illustrates to me what Jesus said in Luke chapter 8, that depending upon the kind of heart that we have, the mind that we possess, results will follow accordingly. And that truth was evidenced there as different people heard the gospel and, depending on their frame of mind, either continued to study or perhaps lost interest as a result. Well, finally, let me suggest that this matter of praying for rulers and those in authority, 1 Timothy chapter 2. Paul there counsels Timothy in his teaching in the previous two verses. Actually, I've given the wrong citation there. Verses 1 and 2, therefore I exhort first of all that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and reverence. And then he goes on in verses 3 and 4 to talk about the gospel by which we can be saved. Paul counseled Timothy and others to pray for the authorities, I believe, so that eventually there would be opportunity to preach the gospel. And one brother in Shenzhen who has been there with the group all along, in fact, I would term him one of the leaders. His name is Bo. He talked several times about the fact that things were seeming to loosen up a little bit, that especially in Shenzhen, there was not as much of a concern for security. And that his hope was that one day, 2 or 3 years down the line, it might be possible to just openly talk about the gospel to other people. Well, I don't know that I would be quite as optimistic as he is, but it does add a realistic attitude to this matter of praying for not only our rulers, but rulers such as those in the communist government that have authority to grant or to refuse certain rights and privileges. And certainly we encourage those brethren to keep praying for their rulers, but that's something I think we can do, and certainly have done in the past, and should continue to do, that other people, even though they may be unknown to us, would have the same privilege and liberty to obey the gospel, to hear it, and to make their decision as a basis of hearing. Well, let me just close by saying that really part of all of this having been said was to just say that I think in many ways the things I've just discussed find their parallels here. That there's a great degree of ignorance in the United States concerning the Bible. That should not be the case, but unfortunately it is. That people are in sin here, that they have a hard time understanding what it means to be separated from God, that the gospel is the solution to that problem, that it's important for us as Christians to grow. It's not just a matter of what the congregation is doing, but individually and personally, it's important that each one of us give time and attention to our own spiritual growth. That indeed, even here, we build on the foundation of others, that the gospel is going to have different results. But as we have even prayed and thought of today, and it has been expressed in a very fine way, what can we do to be those who will reach out and find others as far as the gospel is concerned? I can't go on a trip like this without thinking that I should be making a much greater effort here without having to travel the miles and go to the expense that I've gone, that there's opportunity and potential here, and indeed there is. And I hope that maybe we can all come away, having heard the things I've suggested this evening, with a greater sense of need and immediacy about talking to our friends and neighbors concerning the gospel of Christ. Well, I don't know if that's confused you or helped you as far as the work in China, but I'll certainly be glad to answer any questions. Maybe I've raised more than I've answered by things I've said and maybe not qualified fully. I appreciate your attention and your time. And we want to close, as always, by making the invitation of the gospel. One of the questions that we were asked, or the observation that was made several times, was that what you're teaching is just a Western book. This has come from the West. This is not really concerning Chinese people. And we assured them that as Matthew says in his gospel, as Jesus says in Matthew 28, verse 18, that he is the universal ruler. He is Lord of all. That all authority has been given to him. And on the basis of that authority, he sent his apostles out, not to the West, not to the East, but to make disciples of all nations. It's not a Western book. It's not an Eastern book. It is a book filled with a revelation from God himself, and it is for all of his creation. And that includes us this evening. If you're here and you're not a Christian, there is, I think, no doubt that the message is a great one, that we would go to such time and expense to take it elsewhere, that there is a need to do so, and that if you're here this evening, there is a need to obey that message. If that is your condition, and you recognize your need, and you're willing to act in belief and obey the gospel, we invite you to come as together we stand and sing this song.
Say there's Jesus.